Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Good evening. By pressing play, you've unlocked a door with the key of imagination. Beyond is another dimension, a dimension of sound, a dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. Welcome to Agoraphobia, the Agora Podcast Network's spooktacular month of ghoulishly engaging content, celebrating the spirit of the Halloween season. So turn on all the lights, check all the closets and cupboards, look under the beds, and continue, if you dare. This week, it's double, double, toil and trouble, as Daniel and Claude from the Cannonball combine with Ben Jacobs from the Wittenberg to Westphalia podcast to concoct a troubling witch's brew concerning the works of H.P. Lovecraft, his contributions to horror writing, and his toxic personality that is sure to make your cauldron bubble.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, and welcome to a very special episode of The Cannonball. It's a Cannonball Agoraphobia crossover event. This is a sort of special Halloween episode where we, meaning Daniel and I, are going to be talking to Ben Jacobs from Wittenberg to Westphalia about the works of his beloved author, and maybe Daniel's beloved author, maybe not my favorite author.
I'm beloved of the genre he is writing in, and so I have to respect the guy, and I enjoy some of his. You know what? Yeah, I'm going to stop hemming and hawing. I do enjoy Lovecraft. I'm coming out and staking out the claim, but we'll discover why that can be contentious, or not contentious. I've already just stepped in it.
Yeah.
It's difficult to talk about authors who we admire to some capacity, but whose works I guess, are problematic in some
sure.
way. I'm a little bit more on the problematic end. I think, Daniel, you find some of it a little bit more appealing. And Ben, you're whole hog.
Yeah.
Well, that makes it sound like you're excusing some of the stuff. No, that's not it. But you really are a fan of Lovecraft.
Yeah. I really am a fan of Lovecraft, despite his being a problematic person, yeah. To say the least.
Yeah, problematic person, problematic author, problematic existence. I guess it's all in there. But no, I just didn't want you to think that I'm picking on you or picking on any Lovecraft fans, like, right from the start. It's just, this is kind of a fascinating moment because we have this author who is a major horror author, but one whose, I guess, works are extraordinarily contentious.
And what's weird is he's probably, you know, 100 years after his death, or so, probably at the peak of his popularity, and yet, you know, probably at his most vulnerable.
Well, I would say, kind of at the most. And what's interesting though is he was always at a remove from the main, even the mainstream of racism of his day.
Yeah.
So there's something like maybe that's the secret to his sticking power. It's like everyone knew he was this awful crank. Well, the entire, I don't know.
It's real easy to slip right in here now into talking about all this stuff. So let's maybe we should.
No, that's true. That's true. We're doing a show. Yeah, we started doing a show. So I guess before we really jump out, though, let's see. Claude was going to give us just a couple. For anyone who doesn't know Lovecraft or isn't super familiar with the actual stories that he wrote, they just know maybe through sort of pop cultural osmosis. Claude's going to relate the plots of a couple of his most famous and sort of most essential stories. But before we got to that, Ben, I want you to tell the Cannonball audience what you do over at Wittenberg to Westphalia.
Well, it has nothing to do with literature or horror writing or Lovecraft. my show, Wittenberg to Westphalia, is about, theoretically, the wars of the Protestant Reformation, but I'm taking a really, really deep dive into the causes.
Yeah, yeah.
I've started basically with the fall of the Roman Empire, and I'm working my way up. I've taken a break at the year 1000 to explore the social context of Europe in the Middle Ages, and I'm about through all the scene setting there, and I'm going to start to move on in the next couple episodes. It's been 4 years, and I'm still going strong.
That's fantastic. I will personally attest to very much enjoying your approach to the material, Ben. Like, it's really, I guess when you did first start the show and you started off with just a basic grounding in European geography, I knew this would be my kind of show. but we're really glad to have you on talking Lovecraft. And I guess to start us all off, Claude, please.
All right, so we're to prevent us from being overly abstract, which is really a problem when talking about an author or a work or a time period, we decided to focus on two particular stories, Call of Cthulhu and Shadow Over Innsmouth. For my money, they really sort of are the, maybe not the quintessential Lovecraft, but they've got some of those quintessential elements that make Lovecraft Lovecraft. Mm-hmm. And I think Daniel can talk about those in a little bit. But Call of Cthulhu is sort of it's the mythos that gets spread throughout, you know, most of his works. And it's structurally a pretty weird piece. It begins with this narrator who inherits all of this material from his granduncle, who is a scholar at this local university. His granduncle knows ancient languages and ancient history, and the way he talks about him, the way he writes about this character, it seems sort of close to philology. He's a philologist. The narrator finds this box with clippings and all kinds of material about this cult of Cthulhu, and that's where we get into the narrative of this local sculptor who had come to his granduncle because he was having these hallucinatory visions of this place that did not operate according to Euclidean geometry. He has these horrible nightmares, and he starts sculpting what he sees from those nightmares, and things get worse and worse and worse until they reach a point of no return. He gets extraordinarily ill and feverish, and that's the culmination of all of his nightmarish material. And then once the fever breaks, everything's fine. He has no access to this material anymore, and he goes about his day. In the box is also the narrative of Inspector LeGrasse. So the granduncle talks about meeting this other scholar who had met this inspector in New Orleans, who went to some, archaeologist conference because he had broken up this, set of horrible rites out in the Everglades that were being practiced by a bunch of Creole people. That's going to be important. I'm going to come back to that. Who were sacrificing people to some kind of winged monstrosity. And this was the statue that they were sacrificing people to. So nobody can quite identify it. Nobody quite knows what it is, but it has a correspondence to the sculpture that the original neurotic sculptor had brought to the professor in the first place. And then we move on to the narrative of a Scandinavian sailor who had been it's structurally, I find it structurally fascinating because it's sort of like these box narratives. This is something that I keep finding that Lovecraft comes back to. It's sort of like when we need information, we get some particular character who is the exposition, or some weird kind of side narrative that does the exposition. So there's this narrative of the Scandinavian sailor who was out in the South Pacific with his crew, and then they got boarded by a group of pirates, mixed race pirates, I'll come back to that, who were practitioners of this Cthulhu cult. They have this horrible battle, but the white Scandinavian sailors, most likely due to genetic superiority, Lovecraft's idea is not mine, managed to win the day. But they get stranded on this island that appears out of nowhere. The crew of sailors finds this gigantic structure on the island. They go into the structure. They find this giant demon excrement monster floating at the bottom, who somehow manages to rise up with a huge noxious gas and chase them out to sea. The sailors board the ship, only two of them are left, and instead of trying to get away from this giant excrement monster, they go full speed ahead right through it, ram it, disperse it, and in this sort of sewage-like moment, it seems to pull itself back together, and that's where they somehow manage to make it back to some kind of quote-unquote civilization, and then the Scandinavian sailor is mysteriously killed when a box falls on him. The narrator realizes that all of this stuff signals that there is this cult of people who are trying to raise this dark god Cthulhu, who has existed before time existed. He's one of the dark ones, or the old ones, who live beyond space and time, who are sort of these primeval monsters that don't really care about humanity. It's not that they're immoral, they're just amoral. And what the worshippers of Cthulhu want to do is call these old gods back to destroy all humankind, I guess.
All of existence.
Yeah
basically. So there you go. That's Call of Cthulhu. Alright, so then we read Shadow Over Innsmouth, and again, Shadow Over Innsmouth has this weird kind of narrative structure. It begins almost at the end with the feds raiding the town of Innsmouth. This takes place in the 20s, and the general idea given out is that Innsmouth had been this hub of bootlegging, and what this essentially was shutting down all of these booze factories or covert alcohol activities and just demolishing everything. we go from there to the narrator telling about how he managed to make contact with Innsmouth, and it was all innocent enough. He was on a vacation to do some archival research into his family bloodline. That's when he ended up in the backwoods of New England, and he gets about 5 to 10 pages of exposition from this kindly local bus operator who tells him, in true New England fashion, can't get there from here. So he finds out
you
that...
You gotta go up to the tree where little Billy broke his arm 3 years ago, and then you'll go down to the Red House.
It really does... It really does get into that kind of, I guess, depiction of place. But anyway, so he finds out from this bus operator that there is a bus that'll take him where he wants to go, but he has to stop the night in Innsmouth. And the bus operator tells him all kinds of spooky hearsay about Innsmouth. And he decides on a lark, why not? Why not just go out there? Everyone in Innsmouth is cut off from civilization. They all have the same kind of features. There's, quote-unquote, an Innsmouth look, and they look vaguely fish-like. When he gets to Innsmouth, he realizes that it's kind of dead. There's no one there. There's nothing around. Everything is sort of, like, burnt out and eerie and creepy. He finds a local kid who... Well, he's not a local. He's a kid from a couple towns over, but he works in the grocery store just because he needs the money. And he tells him that if he wants to know anything about Innsmouth, then he should find the town drunk. So the narrator goes and finds the town drunk, gets him boozed up, and then we get another 20 pages of backstory and exposition about how the sort of founding father of the town was this captain who had gone out to the South Pacific. It's always the South Pacific. Anyway, he goes out to the South Pacific and gets involved in these fish demon worship rites from this cult that exists on an island out there somewhere. He brings one of the local girls back and marries her, and that's the beginning of this whole development of fish people, fish demon cult in Innsmouth. They slowly sort of cut themselves off from civilization and start interbreeding with each other to create this half-human, half-fish hybrid demon existence, and everybody at a certain age begins to get the Innsmouth look. They become more fish than human, and then they go off to sea and dive underwater and live forever as fish demons. So the narrator, he doesn't know what to think because this is the town drunk talking, but when he gets back to the local inn, he starts to get more and more creeped out because there are people in the room next door who appear to be trying to break in, and their language is some kind of fishy guttural slobber. He gets out of the inn and starts running throughout the town, and he's being chased by a whole horde of fish people. He hides out from the fish people, makes his way back to the couple towns over, and that's when the narrator calls the feds. So the Fed raid from the beginning was actually instigated by the narrator himself. Wow, he withheld that piece of information. All right, so...
Can I just say that this protagonist deserves the Horror Story Award for being a logical, sane human being? You know, right up until the end, Claude hasn't gotten to yet. But it's just like, you read this and you just go, why doesn't everybody in every horror movie do that? Thank you! People are trying to break into your room in the creepy house. Don't, like, arm yourself. Get out the window!
Yeah. So he does a little... He ends up doing some more genealogical research and finds he's related to the Marsh family, which were the original people who brought the fish people back. He finds himself dreaming of underwater kingdoms and finding that he's growing gills in his neck. Soon he discovers, to his horror, that he is one of the fish people. He's to be one of the crown princes of the fish people. And that's when he devolves into madness.
Yes.
So that's it. All right. The thing that both of these have in common really is this weird narrative structure. I mean, they're genre-wise. I know Daniel's going to talk about the context for the weird. Mm-hmm. But genre-wise, these are both kinds of detective fiction, playing on the tropes of detection, but also playing on that trope in detective fiction of the protagonist somehow also being the perpetrator of the crime. Involved in some way, involved in some capacity. The narrator in Call of Cthulhu is involved to the capacity that just knowing about the cult is one step closer to getting the cult to destroy you or getting the cult to get what it wants. And in Shadow Over Innsmouth, the narrator finds that he himself is the monster. So it I mean, you can take that back to Oedipus. The detective is looking for himself.
Yeah.
No, I mean, seriously, Oedipus is the I think Ross McDonald did an essay on it. Oedipus is kind of like the foundation of detective fiction.
Yeah.
So both of them share that aspect, and there's some of that structural weirdness. I don't know if this was klutzy writing or if Lovecraft was trying to do something with the genre, but there always is this kind of, all right, I must find some kind of source who just takes over the narration and spills everything. It's kind of this fascinating way of doing it. Mm-hmm. These stories within stories within stories. You know, I think Borges would have made more out of that, but it is kind of interesting to see Lovecraft doing that.
So I just want to interrupt real quick and just say that you just said a piece of what makes Lovecraft one of my favorites. It is, I don't know whether he did it on purpose or not.
Yeah. Well
there are parts that I know he did on purpose.
Right.
But and those are probably the worst parts. Maybe. But we'll get to that.
Yeah.
But
that's always the question with Lovecraft.
Yeah.
How much did he do on purpose? Because some of this is ridiculously inept and makes no sense.
Yeah.
And sort of seems like he backfilled it in, but then some of it, is picking from, you know, classical literature with metatextual, you know, meta-narratives, framing devices, and then some of it's picking from detective fiction, and then some of it's just, and then I'll do a flashback to my childhood, I guess.
Right. So, yeah, it's flashbacks within flashbacks and all kinds of weird stuff. All right, so Daniel, Lovecraft is often positioned as being a weird writer.
Yeah.
I mean, what does that mean?
Right. So typically you see Lovecraft either classified as horror or as what's called weird fiction. And unless you are, honestly, unless you're pretty deep in the weeds with, I guess what we might call the fantastical literatures, you're probably not going to heard the term weird fiction, but it's a genre. It's a sort of a term of art for a genre, and it's a bit of a back formation. I'm not entirely sure that anyone during the heyday of weird fiction thought of themselves as being a weird fiction writer. I really feel that's more of a back formation, but this heyday was in the 1920s and 30s, and this was a style of short story that was published typically in the low-quality pulp magazines, which were huge at the time. This was really this was a time in American fiction, at least, where what we might call genre fiction was very much relegated to this kind of the gutter of the pulp magazine. This would have been like a weekly or usually monthly, cheap, printed on cheap paper, which is why it's called pulp, and generally considered disposable. And so the fact that scholarship has even emerged around a lot of these genres and a lot of these writers is itself a kind of almost like found art. I don't know. But anyway, well, I guess there's Dickensian antecedent for the kind of just the hack writer churning out stuff and it actually getting a lot of critical attention. But we're talking specifically about, this is a genre that emerged almost entirely out of one publication called Weird Tales. So this was a pulp magazine called Weird Tales. It began publication in 1924 out of Chicago in a publishing house called Rural Publications. So if anybody wants to get get their Third Coast Neurosis on, there you go. It was publishing stories. This was in the 20s and 30s. This was a time when what we might call the genre boundaries were not very. It was a very fluid time. So this was also around the same time that Hugo Gernsback started up his Astounding Stories. Amazing Stories. I'm sorry. Astounding would come later. That's Joseph W. Campbell, and that's the foundation of hard science fiction, but we won't get into that. sorry, guys. I love this shit. But this was a time when the kind of there was an appetite for like fantastical literature, but it wasn't really all that firmly in place. Like, what was fair game for what genre or what have you? So, Weird Tales was this magazine that published what we today would call things like space opera. Just like, you know, grand scale planet hopping science fiction romance, pioneered by an Edmund Hamilton, and he was one of their most published authors. This also published, and I thought this was pretty great. Their most, by far the biggest star that Weird Tales had, who published regularly, was a guy named Seabury Quinn, and he did these stories. It was an Inspector Jules de Grandin, occult detective. Basically, it was like X-Files 1932. It's phenomenal to like just read the synopses of these things. Honestly, like Seabury Quinn is like for such a pillar of the Weird Tales magazine, which is itself such a legend. He's really fallen out of favor. Nobody really reads him anymore. Nobody really cares about him anymore. His sort of second bananas are the guys that we talk about. Guys like Lovecraft. Guys like Robert E. Howard of the Conan the Barbarian stories. Guys like Clark Ashton Smith, who is, for my money, I think the vastly superior practitioner of weird fiction, compared to Lovecraft. Seabury Quinn was by far he's the guy who paid the bills around there, writing stories about like this occult detective who finds out that the murders were committed by a werewolf or a vampire, you know, that kind of stuff. But all these stories had in common their kind of antecedents in earlier forms of fantastical literature, like, you know, we're all familiar with like Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, and that was this genre called scientific romance. It's not quite science fiction as we know it. And it had fallen out of favor by the teens and 20s, even though I don't think Verne was publishing anymore, but Wells was still publishing at the time. But his great classics like The Invisible Man and War of the Worlds, those were from kind of the late 19th century. By this time, you saw a kind of an upswing in what were called lost race stories. And the lost race story is basically like anytime you've like read a story about an underground civilization that threatens humankind, that's a lost race story. Or they can also be situated in remote places on the planet Earth. So you might have honestly, like Gorilla City in the DC Comics universe is basically a lost race story. It's a story where there's a powerful civilization hidden away somewhere that can threaten the rest of us.
I mean, it's worth saying that the entire early comic book genre was basically just lifting stories out of the pulp.
Totally.
So the entire comic book genre, as we understand it, is basically based on pulp novel stories recycled.
Yeah, absolutely. And another big well that the writers of Weird Tales would draw on was the Theosophy movement. And this was a kind of a movement in occultism and spiritualism in the late 19th century and early 20th century. It really gained a lot of ground. There were theosophy societies in every major city and most minor cities all across America and Europe and even in India, which honestly they were kind of cribbing half-baked Hinduism for a lot of their stuff, but they still opened up schools in India. But I think one of the key elements that fed into the weird fiction genre in Lovecraft, especially, that was present in Theosophy, was the idea that humankind has a very, very deep history, not an evolutionary deep history as we understand it, but a deep history of forgotten knowledge and forgotten civilizations and preceding civilizations that were superior in some ways and very different, and that this history was accessible through occultism. That was a huge, huge influence on a lot of these stories as well. And of course, there's just the pulps in general. You know, these were cheap. These were meant to be turned out. These were, you know, your editor would be slamming on the desk saying like, you know, I don't care if it's art. Just give me, you know, 5,000 words by Thursday. So there was a great deal. And I think honestly, this feeds into some of the structural elements that Claude was talking about. Yeah. That I think when Lovecraft is doing it unintentionally, I think he's writing to a deadline. Or he's writing to churn it out, and like, how can I get this idea that's in my head out? Oh, I know, I'll have the town drunk explain it.
It's also really fascinating because there's a lot of Lovecraft that taps into the same kinds of social anxieties that the modernists were responding to. Mm-hmm. Now, he is definitively anti-modern.
Yeah.
That's sort of going throughout. But there's this weird kind of aspect of the modernists that could often be extraordinarily revanchist. I mean, the most well-known, I guess, would be Ezra Pound and the sort of fascist wing of modernism. But even, well, T.S. Eliot was a sort of staunch conservative through, I guess, the midpoint of, well, pretty early in his career and all the way throughout. Lovecraft is often, with the cosmic horror, tapping into those same kind of social anxieties. The modern era, or the early 20th century, was one where there was rapid, unprecedented technological, social, political, economic, you name it, change. Mm-hmm. And there was this constant sense of being separated from the past, or separated from any kind of foundation that could guide you into understanding the moment. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of correspondent with this constant anxiety he has about the meaninglessness of existence. Mm-hmm. The cosmological horror is basically one of sort of pessimistic nihilism.
Yeah, I think you're hitting on something. Sorry to interrupt, Claude, but like that, I think you're hitting on kind of a germ of a lot of these, and the fact that a lot of these genres were not well defined at the time is because they're all emerging out of this sort of modernist anxiety. Yeah. And I think in the science fiction route that eventually emerges, it's an attempt to master modernism, and it's fantasy, it's a reaction to sort of reject it or pretend that it's not there, perhaps, or at least to try to recover values that are not possible. And with the Lovecraft vein, with the weird fiction vein, or at least the Lovecraftian weird fiction vein, it's utter nihilism in the face of it.
He does read modernism as a version of decadence. Mm-hmm. Like when the sculptor is producing artworks to try to capture this primeval chaos, the description he has sounds like, you know, Picasso.
Yeah.
Yeah.
More or less. So it's reactive to that. And I think you're absolutely right that when faced with that, it's okay, shut down, the end, nothing, we have degenerated. We'll get into his racial politics in a bit, but this very idea of the degeneration of humanity and the end of humanity is very much connected to that pessimism, but also connected to his racial politics.
Yeah.
And I think
you can't not see it.
And I think, sorry, go ahead then.
That's maybe a conversation for later.
I think what might help us sort of approach all of this is learning, well, how did H.P. Lovecraft himself come to be writing these stories? Yes. Who is this guy?
Yeah, and that's...
All right, so I'll handle... So the idea that was just said that I think is really important, that there was a ton of change happening.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to start there. H.P. Lovecraft was born in 1890. And that's pretty important because in 1893, that's when it was declared, for what it's worth, that the American frontier was closed. That didn't really matter to Lovecraft. He's from New England. He's born in Providence, which is where I live now. But that sort of helps us set sort of the frame of what's going on in the United States at that time. A huge amount of change. America's going from being this agrarian frontier society that economy is geared towards developing the frontier to being a consumer-oriented society the way it is now. And the entrepôts of the East Coast are serving that need. So that's an important bit of background. Providence itself is a city that I like to tell people it never really recovered from the war, by which I mean the Civil War. It was at one time an extremely wealthy city, but its biggest peak relative to the other cities was in arms manufacturing for the Civil War. And then after that, it still was a powerful and important center, but it was just dwarfed by its neighbors and always sort of was just kind of hanging on after that. So when Lovecraft himself was born, that's sort of the setting he's born into, this New England setting of economic mediocrity, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Providence is a very old town. Lovecraft's family was a very old family, but they weren't one of the wealthy ones. His father, was a traveling salesman, and his grandfather, his maternal grandfather, was also a traveling salesman. So the men in his life were absent, particularly so because his father ended up coming down with syphilis, which syphilis, if left untreated, drives you insane. So be safe, kids. And he ended up having a nervous breakdown when Lovecraft was 3 and getting sent to a mental asylum, where he lingered for several years before dying.
Hmm.
Of course, Lovecraft wasn't told as a kid that his father had syphilis, and if he was ever told, he never told anyone else.
Yeah.
He would tell people that his father died of a nervous breakdown caused by overwork. Okay.
Huh. So yeah, the cover story was just marinated in Calvinist work ideology. Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So that left him growing up with his mother, her 3 sisters. I'm sorry, his mother, her 2 sisters, his grandmother, and then his only real male role model as a child was his maternal grandfather, who then is a traveling salesman. So mostly he's only interacting with this guy via correspondence, via letters, which is important. That's his formative relationship. He was very sickly, and mostly lived getting doted on by these women, hand and foot. And then occasionally his grandfather would come in to do things like cure him of being afraid of the dark by forcing him to walk repeatedly through dark rooms. So, wow. Not quite child abuse,
yeah.
But very Calvinist New England. So, the family suffered from a gradually worsening financial situation, which then created more issues for him. He went to a prestigious high school, and had a group of friends who he enjoyed spending time with, but, you know, his family was having financial issues. He probably had health issues. There was stress involved. He eventually had a nervous breakdown in his last year of high school, so he never really got his high school diploma directly. There's some confusion as to whether he eventually got one. In any case, he never actually went on to college, which would, of course, be a problem for him in terms of his further career. He also had, of course, no practical skills, because, you right. know.
Yeah.
But he was very well educated. Like, he consumed vast amounts of books, but he was an autodidact. He would go through the libraries around here in Providence, which are completely wonderful. The Providence Athenaeum still exists. You can get weddings there. It's
hey,
beautiful.
Neat.
Absolutely
yeah.
beautiful building, yeah. And he would just hang out there all the time. He had a, you know, group of friends that he would hang out with there, sort of. He became an amateur journalist and actually, in that capacity, wrote polemics against people who would write for lowbrow publications for money, which is ironic.
Oh, beautiful, yeah. His whole life is one giant cell phone, in a way.
He's got this huge self-hate thing going
yeah.
on. Like, he loves being around people, but it clearly drains him. And then he'll self-isolate and then need people, and it's, I'll get to that. As he was sort of moving out into this amateur journalist world and starting to get some acclaim and meeting people and really building a name for himself, his mother had a nervous breakdown and was committed to a hospital. The same mental hospital where his father had been sent, in which place she got some gallbladder surgery that went wrong and she died.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the fact that his father died of syphilis does raise the question about his mother having mental issues and dying in a mental hospital. But let's move on. That is reportedly what happened. The fact is, though, that both of his parents died lingering deaths in Butler Mental Hospital in Providence, Rhode Island.
Yeah.
In his living memory. In his mother's case, anyway. In his memory. So, at one of these amateur journalist conventions, he met Sonia Green, And they got married, apparently a very healthy relationship. His aunts objected to the relationship, but in a sort of act of defiance, he got married to her. Particularly, this was defiant because she was a Jewish woman, and he had written several... This is an interesting point, because he'd written numerous polemics against the Jews as a journalist, and some of his fiction that he wrote as a kid made unkind comments about the Jews. Just cards on the table, I'm Jewish.
Yeah.
So, okay. So
I think that's one of many reasons why your perspective as a Lovecraft fan, I think, is really fascinating, Ben. Just like...
Yeah.
Anyway, okay. Sorry, that perspective that you bring to it. But anyway, continue.
Sure. So he got married to her, and she, you know, maybe it was because the aunts, which was his entire family, objected to her. But her account of it is that she thought that he was being held back by his family, and she wanted to move to New York, which they did. And she said she was totally fine supporting him financially because she believed in him as a writer. She was totally supportive of him. She had a business, and they were going to move to New York. He was going to move into the literary scene in New York, where he would move past his provincial Providence background and actually, like, move out into the world, get past his background, and, you know, flourish. Unfortunately, financial issues sort of intervene again here, because almost as soon as they moved to New York, her business failed. She was able to keep it going for a year or two, and then it failed. There were national financial problems as well at the time. This whole period, sort of 1885 to 1945 to 1950, is just repeated booms and busts in the United States, right? Mm-hmm. Punctuated by wars. And so that's very much the context that we're in. Things for Lovecraft to look okay, and then the economy will flip up, and it'll be that much worse on the socioeconomic scale. So one of these things happen, she loses her business, she can't support him or them anymore. She gets a job opportunity out in Cincinnati. He gets a job opportunity in Chicago to be the editor at Weird Tales.
Yeah, yeah.
He turns it down. She accepts the job in Cincinnati. So she moves to Cincinnati, and she's sending money back to him. And so he's moving, and the part of the reason he didn't move to Chicago is he's in New York, in Manhattan. He's living this really exciting life. He's moving in these really exciting bohemian literary circles, full of some big names that I don't remember. but a number of them were Jewish, and none of them were homosexuals, although he probably didn't know about that,
right.
Because the vaguest mention of sex would set him sweating. and so she moves to Cincinnati, but eventually they're you know, the situation keeps getting worse. He's making, like, no money. So he has to move to Red Hook in Brooklyn, which is a very working class part of Brooklyn, a part of, you know, New York, at the time, full of, you know, that's where all the bootlegging was happening, all the organized crime. It's full of dock workers. It's probably very exciting, but it's also full of crime. And eventually the apartment is robbed. He loses everything. He hangs on for, like, a couple more months, and then basically heads back to Providence, where, you know, they have, up at this point, lived apart for a couple of years. He divorces Sonia, but he tells her that he's agreed to the divorce, but he never actually signs the papers, which she doesn't find out about until she tries to get remarried.
Yeah.
So he spends another 10 years living in Providence, living off basically whatever he could get from writing and a tragically dwindling inheritance. Basically, he survives by not spending money, you know?
Yeah.
Lives this extremely frugal existence. Basically, only he gets his entertainment by going to the Athenaeum. And he eventually contracted colon cancer and suffered this very long, slow, lingering death. A couple things to just highlight here. because I didn't quite get it to it in the narrative. Mm-hmm. His biggest, he had a couple times in his life where he had real strong social networks, but they're sort of these brief periods, apparently in high school, and then when he was, for a couple years when he was living in Manhattan. He seems to have sort of lost all of it when he went to Brooklyn, because he was embarrassed by his financial situation and stressed out and stuff. But he maintained this really, really lively correspondence to the point that cataloging and maintaining his volume, like there's 3,000 volumes of his letters, something like.
Wow.
Like there's a whole academic discipline just to organizing, collating, and scanning these things. So he clearly appreciated the, you know, contact with his fellow human beings, but he never really had periods where he really did it energetically for a very long time.
Yeah.
It clearly drained him. He clearly had some sort of depression, I think. It's hard to really diagnose someone or, you know, call it a social anxiety kind of thing or something. I don't want to armchair diagnose the guy. It's not useful for anybody, but he had some sort of chronic illness, mm-hmm, of the mental variety, probably, that was keeping him from interacting with people long term. But he clearly enjoyed it. He mostly got it through correspondence. And then the one thing that I started out with that I should have mentioned more then. So, right, his main male role model was his grandfather, who was 70 when he died.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking in the 1890s to his father died when his grandfather died when Lovecraft was like 10-ish, I think. So this is the main formative influence on Lovecraft. He, you know, started reading and writing when he was 3 and mostly interacted through his grandfather through letters and books and stuff. So his main formative influence was a 70-year-old man in the 1890s. Lovecraft writes and has the opinions of a person who came of age intellectually in 1840.
Yeah, yeah.
That is, I'm going to just suggest that and put that on the table. So, all right. So,
yeah.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, it's weird because, yeah, that's true. And at the same time, he's also clearly responding to other things that are operant in the culture, you know? So, like, I just don't want to dismiss his white supremacist outlook. And it is white supremacist. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
I don't want to dismiss that as being sort of a holdover necessarily from one personal relationship, because it did correspond to a whole discourse that was happening in the culture.
Sure.
I mean, you know,
I would say, well, this is another thing that we probably want to come back to, but
well, it's, you know, Birth of a Nation brought back the whole idea of, I guess, winning the South over. It brought back the Klan. It literally brought back the Klan.
Yeah. Well, this was
that's the same time period in which Lovecraft is writing.
Yeah.
That's the same moment.
Mm-hmm.
These are the ideas that were in the air as well. So,
sure.
You know,
yeah.
I'm not trying to dismiss what you just said, but I'm also like, I'm curious why that moment would allow for that stuff to come back.
There's some other, he was reacting to a lot of stuff in the culture. He also comes off, and this is somewhat splitting hairs, but like, I don't care what kind of bigot he was clearly a bigot. But he comes off, when you read in detail, as more of an elitist bigot than necessarily a genetic-based bigot.
Sure.
Because it changes his opinions when he gets in contact with people.
Yeah.
But it's in the work, it's white supremacist.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, in the work, it is white supremacist.
Totally.
It's okay, but the horrors in Call of Cthulhu do not come from indigenous races or ethnicities. The horrors come from the mixing of races.
Right.
Everyone involved in the Cthulhu cult is mixed race, and he draws attention to that. That's one of the things that I'm saying is that's intentional.
Yeah.
That, I mean, that's not accidental. That is absolutely intentional. And the horror aspects of his writing are directly connected to this white supremacist view.
Yeah.
Whatever his personal opinions were, in the work itself, it's clearly white supremacist.
I'll say I agree. I will just say that for him, he would have these opinions and then he'd walk them back as he gained experience with other people. So
yeah,
you know, he was an anti-Semite till he met his wife, and then he excused it to people by saying she was well assimilated, which
right.
Is
right. So it still works in that, but like that kind of like WASP supremacist framework there. But I take your meaning, Ben. Like it's a kind of well, you know, he's a poster, right? He's an internet poster, and he's throwing hard on the forums. But then when we actually see him in person, you know, he's you know, he's like, oh, well, you know, like, I guess they're not a mud person, you know.
Yeah, when he gets outside his comfort zone and he meets people and has to treat them like human beings, all of a sudden he realizes that, well, yeah, actually they are human beings.
But I think what's interesting is that his you know, he'll always revert to that kind of deep set, you know, however it was inculcated. And it comes out in his art, yeah. That deep set sense of unease with this mixing with different peoples. And another thing, like Claude mentioned, you know, Birth of a Nation, the resurgence of the Klan. This was also the time of basically the invention of illegal immigration as we know it, in scientific assessment, pseudoscientific assessment. This was the time of the Immigration Acts of 1924 that began the quota system. Where there would be,
right.
You could only let in a certain amount of people a year, and the Congress like drew up the law. Actually, has like a table of allowing this number of people from these countries and areas that specifically maps to the pseudoscientific, you know, skull caliper race science of the time.
Philology.
Right. Yeah. And that kind of, which adds a kind of like, you know, there was a this was a moment. This was also the moment of the eugenics movement. There was just this moment this concern, this deep set concern about where does human flourishing come from, and these people are so glommed onto bolting on their inherited racism onto this, you know, pseudoscientific approach.
What it seems to be always operating is that there's this kind of Spenglerian decline of the West pessimism in Lovecraft, mm-hmm. that he wants to link to this kind of despair at the nothingness of the universe. I mean, this is also the moment where physics is pushing beyond the immediately observable and getting into the fantastic and strange itself,
right,
so that you can't even wrap your mind around how the universe operates. I mean, the Einsteinian universe is chaotic.
And specifically called out by him as chaotic.
Yeah. And so that's, I mean, he wants to link these things to this kind of scientific discourse, but when it comes down to the actual horror, it always is the degeneracy of the white race.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, again and again and again, Shadow Over Innsmouth strikes me as a kind of parable about what happens when you, I guess, have children with someone who is racially other. And it, like, that is, like, again and again, I can't look at this stuff and not see that.
Well, I think
it's a persistent aspect of his writing.
Yeah, there's one story in particular, and I cannot remember the exact title of it, but it, Claude, I was reminded when you talked about that sort of tradition in detective genre writing, where it turns out that the detective is somehow instrumental in the crime itself. There was one particular story, and Ben would probably know, actually, but the big reveal, the big horrible reveal for this man who's researching his family history, and he's also sort of observing the stuffed ape collection that his explorer grandfather or father has assembled or whatever, or some kind of relative. Anyway, it turns out that he himself is the product of interspecies copulation between right, apes yeah, and right. men. And that's like the horror that drives him insane and stuff. And that's, but yeah, I think that ties into a neat little bow. These two trends of like the detective who was yeah. himself part of the crime and also this white racial panic.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's okay. So why does, all right, Daniel, I'm going to throw this back to you yeah. though. Why has Lovecraft taken off? Like what has been the posthumous career?
Right.
Why is this anti-Semitic racist freak?
Yeah, how did this?
Who basically died in poverty, unloved and, by anyone?
Yeah, how like, the heck what? Do we know who this guy's name is? Well, it comes back to one of his Weird Tales colleagues, basically. Like, I mean, it really does go back to one guy, a guy named August Derleth, who had been actually called out in a couple of Lovecraft stories as, I believe, like Comte de Leth or something. Like there's a sort of incidental character whose name is a kind of joke on August Derleth's name. So, but August Derleth was, again, one of the tent poles of Weird Tales. He published a lot of stuff in Weird Tales. But he was also an admirer of Lovecraft and a frequent correspondent. And this was kind of, he was part of a circle of correspondence with these guys like, well, I mentioned Robert E. Howard of Conan the Barbarian fame and Clark Ashton Smith. They corresponded a lot with one another. They shared a lot of ideas. They called each other out in their stories and stuff. And August Derleth was kind of part of that circle. So when H.P. Lovecraft died, August ended up with a number of his, or at least he claimed to end up with a number yeah. of his papers. And kind of his papers and notes, his outlines for stories. And so for the first few years after Lovecraft died, August Derleth would publish stories that he had written based off those purported notes and credit them to August Derleth and H.P. Lovecraft. And this was apparently like really frowned upon at the time. And I didn't really dig too much into the controversy, but people basically assumed like August Derleth was passing off his own work under the name of at the time, the more famous H.P. Lovecraft. Or at least the more respected, like, would get you published in the reconstituted Weird Tales, because it actually, the Weird Tales of the 1950s was a different magazine that had basically been rebooted. But it did lead to some kind of, and August Derleth had his own sort of modest success, and he would write, I think one of the interesting aspects of Lovecraft's career, and a lot of these guys, is that there was the Cthulhu mythos, as we mentioned, it was a shared, what we call today a shared universe. But that is a setting with characters and elements that different writers would employ, and so as which implying a kind of continuity among their different stories. But August Derleth was kind of the guy who kind of catalyzed all that. He really, if there is anything close to a kind of canon of Cthulhuism, August Derleth is the guy who made it gel together. And he continued publishing. He actually founded his own publishing house called Arkham House that would continue to publish and republish H.P. Lovecraft stories and some of the other Weird Tales guys. And interestingly, I thought this was very interesting about August Derleth. Arkham House also published a lot of really groundbreaking, envelope-pushing feminist science fiction. He was actually publishing, I think most famously, Joanna Russ, who would end up publishing the Hugo Award-winning The Female Man, which is just a stunning work of 1970s sort of new wave feminist science fiction that is a good example of how the doors were blown off of the whole Golden Age attitude by that time. But that's kind of the germ of how the sort of the torch of Lovecraft was kept borne aloft. So through the 70s, Lovecraft's reputation was kind of on the rise. He would appear in anthologies more. His reprinted stories would sell on the kind of the news racks with all the rest of the science fiction paperback crap, which I dearly love and have a vast collection of myself. Here's my thesis, and Ben, you can push back on this. I feel like the reason why Lovecraft has survived and thrived and found as much what we might call viral success to this day is because he became implanted in the incipient nerd culture of role-playing games in the early 1980s.
I think that's about I think that's fairly accurate.
Okay. And I thought this was interesting because I was doing a little bit of research because there was... So we all know Dungeons & Dragons, and that was kind of the granddaddy of them all. And Dungeons & Dragons itself is a kind of... You might think of it as a way to create, you know, sort of, you know, Tolkien Xeroxed 50,000 times kinds of narratives with your friends sitting around the table. But that also, it kicked off this trend of people coming up with rules to be able to, you and your friends could act out pastiches of an author's style with each other. You could create a collaborative fan fiction, basically. And Lovecraft's work got picked up in all this, and with the publication of Call of Cthulhu, the role-playing game, beginning in 1981. Since then, it is still ongoing. It is an ongoing game system. It has run through a ton of editions, as you might expect, for a, 30-odd... 37-year-old, game property. So I think by Lovecraft's mythos becoming part of that burgeoning role-playing game community, which perpetuated itself in the kind of the comic book stores and the game stores and the early internet of its day, which became one of the kernels of what we today call nerd culture, which has become the absolute dominant popular culture on the planet right now. Which is extremely odd, having been a young nerd in the 90s. When what's amazing is I will tell people there was a time when you couldn't buy Star Wars toys if you wanted to. They were nowhere. The people don't believe me. Anyway, but I think another contributing element to the survival of Lovecraft as a person at Touchstone belongs to the film Reanimator. By Stuart Gordon, directed by Stuart Gordon, released in 1985. And this was a huge cult horror hit. And I think that helped keep Lovecraft in the realm of sort of what we would think of as horror, even though the stories themselves as weird fiction touch on what we today consider science fiction elements or fantasy elements. So Reanimator, if you haven't seen it, check it out. It's gross. It's a fun horror movie. But it was based on a Lovecraft story. Simply because as I understand the legend, the director Stuart Gordon was tired of all the vampire movies and wanted to make a Frankenstein movie. But you couldn't really make a Frankenstein movie because everyone was tired of Frankenstein movies because everyone makes a Frankenstein movie. So he found some other kind of reanimated corpse story, which was one of Lovecraft's sort of better known stories, Herbert West Reanimator. So I think the dual lodging of Lovecraftism or sort of the Lovecraft style in the kind of germ of what became nerd culture, which really took off in the 2000s with the internet. I think the credit belongs to the Call of Cthulhu RPG and the Reanimator film, which sort of lodged itself in the horror fan consciousness. And what's fascinating to me, anyway, is that Stuart Gordon, in order to read the story, it was out of print. He had to go to the Chicago Library archives, like the Chicago Stacks, to find a copy of the story to read. So I think that's why it deserves some credit for keeping the flame alive here. But I think that's kind of a rough and ready history of how the flickering torch of an extremely racist weirdo from the 20s was kept alive this whole time. With this compelling, it was what was compelling to a lot of people for various reasons that I think Ben can speak to coming up here. But that's how the flame was kept alive. But what led this efflorescence, like what, when we talk about Lovecraft today, when we talk about what we like about him, what are we talking about?
I'm going to jump in and, you know, I want to fill in a couple things there.
Oh, please, yeah.
Not in terms of Lovecraft himself, but in terms of the wider culture. I think you did a great job in nailing down the pulp culture side of the transmission chain. Mm-hmm. And then on the modern side, you know, the Call of Cthulhu game, definitely. Leading into what I want to talk about, there was this rise of cult movies, B-movies, and things that sort of... intellectual properties that consciously, or that their fans enjoyed, because they rejected the idea of high art.
Sure, yeah.
And so, you can think of Ed Wood, Devo, you know, Cher, to a certain extent, you know, kung fu movies.
Yeah.
And there's a, you know, discussion around this, and I don't know how much it's been fleshed out in, you know, in academic circles or anything, because I'm not in any way.
Well, I think honestly, like Claude, in your study of canonicity, I think this touches very, very closely upon it. But again, I guess, like you said, so, in the chat, we don't have time for dissertations.
Yeah, let me just real quick run through my notes here.
Sure.
And then we can go nuts. The concepts I want to talk about are camp and kitsch, which are sort of two sides of the same coin, and the only difference, almost from a legal standpoint, is intention.
Mm-hmm.
They're both over the top, they're melodramatic content, they completely fly in the face of good taste, and what you might call mainstream aesthetics. They may have some compelling core, some compelling, interesting narrative core. They may have something that they're trying to say, but the setting is just all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of camp, the setting is intentionally all over the place. The setting is part of the message, usually, in terms of camp. They're poking their finger up the nose of mainstream society and saying, what you gonna do about it?
Yeah.
So, you know, John Waters movies.
Yeah.
Again, Devo, you know, very much getting up in your face and saying, you know, I eat filth.
Or as the I think the famous Divine line in one of those movies, like, what are your political views? And she replies, kill everyone now.
So the flip side of that is kitsch, which is basically all those things, except you are left wondering whether it was done through intentional means or through failure.
Yeah.
Because kitsch, the transgression of mainstream aesthetics, is often completely unintentional. It's done through incompetence. It's done through a lack of a budget. It's done because the person just doesn't, you know, just, I said incompetent. So, kitsch things are like kung fu movies, where there's a language barrier and a culture barrier. And I mentioned Ed Wood, so you can also think of The Room, movies like that. There's a great local institution, which if you're ever in the Northeast, I highly recommend checking out, called the Museum of Bad Art. It is located in front of a men's restroom. So, you know, these are the things that you'd call so bad they're good. You know, that kind of thing. So, Lovecraft, for me, is probably in the kitsch area.
Yeah.
I love his work. His prose is beautiful. It is extremely lush.
Yeah.
It sounds like a person who was 70 in 1890 wrote it.
The thing has been, I think that's like, it's a matter for taste, but I think that's another reason why I have found his work compelling also. Like, it's a kind of, it's a kind of writing that is not very common today, and is also, itself extremely difficult to pull off without being just awful. And I would compare it to, have you ever read any Jack Vance? Have either of you read science fiction author Jack Vance?
No.
Okay.
No.
You two are getting care packages in the mail.
Sweet.
I think he's a great example of lush done right. But anyway, I'm sorry. Yeah, continue, Ben.
No. A lot of the pulp authors had, a lot of them that I have read, I haven't read as many as I'd like because I have this podcast. I read nothing but books about witches being burned all the time.
But, and I'm over anyway, here. I can't read nothing but great literature. It's awful.
God damn it. It's awful. Can I curse?
Yeah, go for it. I'm sorry. I do on the cannonball. So.
Okay. Sweet. I'm from New Jersey, so I spend my entire show trying to keep my New Jersey under control.
Yeah, gotcha.
His prose is, but all these you read two pulp novelists and they all have wildly different styles, which is, and none of them are right in terms of the mainstream at that time.
Yeah.
So I think that itself is particularly fun. But Lovecraft himself is ridiculously repetitive. All of his, you know, most of his stories end up with someone stumbling on something and going insane, right?
Right.
He's got his own tropes. you know, he finds a toaster and he goes insane. He's terrified of things that are taken for granted by, you know, modern society, like relativity theory, minorities and lady parts. And, you know, in general, the structure of his stories, as we've addressed, often fails utterly in terms of being coherent. And you're left wondering, was that intentional? Was he doing some sort of, you know, meta-narrative? Or was... You know, is the fact that none of this makes sense part of the fact that the narrator's insane? Or is it just that Lovecraft was kind of a hack writing for a pulp thing, and he was just kind of like, ah, whatever, they're fine, I'll take it. So, you know, I see him as definitely kitsch, and I really enjoy him because I enjoy sitting there and trying to take apart how much of it was intentional, given the fact that you really can't assume intentionality with Lovecraft in any way. Because he wasn't incompetent. He was really well read, but there's just so much about him that, you know, he had a variety of mental health issues. He was extraordinarily sheltered. He basically was self-taught, so how much, you know, yes, he was well read, but what was it he was reading?
Right.
You know. So that's where I come from. And I just want to finish up by mentioning Poe's Law, which is something that's come off the internet, but I think it's an important part of this conversation, which is that, for me, I appreciate Lovecraft because, you know, sarcastically, I think he's a pitiful story.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly don't look to him as an example for my politics. And, you know, I basically, I'm able personally to appreciate him because he was basically harmless. Because he died, you know, unloved and in poverty.
Hmm.
And, you know, he wrote a couple articles and op-eds that were probably not appreciated in local Providence politics. But in the grand scheme of things, with everything else that was going on in the 40s, like, this guy wasn't exactly an opinion maker.
Sure.
That said, as the popularity of Lovecraft expands, Poe's Law comes into effect, which essentially says that it's impossible to come up with a proposition that is obviously sarcasm in modern internet society because someone somewhere will take it seriously, no matter how ridiculous or outrageous it might seem.
Right.
So, to me, saying that Lovecraft is, you know, not an example to follow because he's a racist and a misogynist and kind of a broken person, you know, is obvious, but there are people out there who may look at him as an example of a great racist writer, just their kind of guy, and that makes me feel like I need to take a shower.
You're right, right.
No, no, there are. There are sincere readings of him, either in the racist vein or in that sort of dark enlightenment vein that look at this as a kind of Nietzschean response to the void. I don't see that at all. I honestly don't. Okay, he's kind of fascinating. Okay, as an academic, because he's working so hard to stress his credentials. Like,
yes.
I mean, that's one of the other weird things about Call of Cthulhu is that the format of it, like the genre structure of it, is kind of like detective novel, but apparently for the really smart elite intelligence.
Yes.
He makes all these stabs at academia, but
he so desperately wants to be part of it.
But you can tell from a mile away that this is not academic at all. There's no part of this that coheres to any kind of academic understanding.
Yeah.
So he's showing that sort of autodidacticism, but that's you know, that's an interesting part of him. But overall, I don't know. I find him so extraordinarily problematic, and the writing is usually so turgid, and the stories are so repetitive that I really don't see why it has a following. But I think your sort of kitsch explanation, mixed in with what I think Daniel was talking about with the ubiquity of these ideas in the culture being spread out through means other than his writing itself. It's like, yeah, Lovecraftian is more of a draw than the actual stories of Lovecraft.
Yeah,
in some capacity.
Absolutely. Well, and
I'd say that's true.
Yeah, and I think you're hitting on it there, Claude. And I guess this is where I'll say where I guess I'm left to. And the thing is, like Ben, I'm very much a guy who appreciates some good kitsch. Like I am 100% right on board with you. Which is an appreciation of the kitsch ethos and finding, yeah, finding joy in things that no one ever thought anyone would ever watch again. I'm deadly serious. Like it's literally the purest reaction of joy that I have to anything is laughing at how ridiculous, yeah, something that no one ever assumed anyone would watch 40 years later, you know, is. But I think, Claude, you're hitting on something, and I think you're hitting on it's the Lovecraftian is where the appeal is, and what does that mean in today's day and age? I think it has everything to do with the kind of cosmic alienation element. I think that's what people respond to the most, and I know that's what I've responded to the most in my sort of in my history with Lovecraft stories. And like I've said, like, you know, Lovecraft was absolutely my window into some other writers working in similar veins that I enjoy a lot more. But I'll still read a Lovecraft story. And to me, the value or the compelling part of it that I get out of it is that horror of facing up to the complete and as a human being, like as a human social, as a social ape, which is who we are and we cannot escape it, as a social ape whose body has evolved, whose entire being has evolved to interrelate with other beings to the extent that we project personalities onto things that do not have them all the time. I think the real horror element that Lovecraft capably executes and that really draws people in is driving home the idea that the universe is absolutely under the control of things that have never even bothered to consider caring about something like you. That you will never cross the mind of the thing that destroys you. And that's a very different kind of horror than being the subject of, than being the prey of a predator, which is another kind of, like, that's a primal horror. That's, you know, because we were terrified of being devoured by leopards, and today the slasher movie is, you know, that's you are prey of a predator. What kind of, it's a very different kind of horror, it's a very different kind of facing up to doom that comes with the idea that completely impersonal forces will grind you to dust and no one will remember, yeah, that you ever lived. And that's, I think, a very 20th century horror that carries through to the 21st. And I to me, I think that's where a lot of the love, and of course, there's the surface elements of, like, yeah, gross tentacles and insane and monsters that drive, yeah, you insane. You know, that's fun too, but I think that would be the, I guess, the appeal. That would be to me the kernel that attracts people to the, yeah, Lovecraftian idea.
The nugget there that he was trying to convey, maybe, that, you know, is worth cutting through everything else in order to get to. And it's actually such a hard horror to wrap your mind around, mm-hmm, that it's almost never done completely right.
Yeah,
even,
yeah,
by Lovecraft.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, there's still people who are menaced and have to flee from something. You know, like, it's still,
yeah, there. And, yeah, the whole, like, you know, mixed race interlocutors is sort of a distraction, honestly, from
the narrative
that he's actually trying to do.
Right. Well, but he's trying to do the lost. He's trying to do the miscegenation horror. But I think it's less conscientious the cosmic horror. I think I think he's trying to do the, yeah, race horror, but he's also touching upon, yeah, the the thing that we're responding to a little more, sort of almost, right. Not exactly incidentally, but it is tied up together. But I think, sorry.
I think it is tied up together more than is comfortable, at least for me.
Okay.
Because you can, like, I see what y'all are talking about, that kernel there of basically being crushed by a more powerful thing that is not cognizant that you are even human, which I mean strikes me as the inverse of his own othering. Do you know when I feel that horror?
Mm-hmm.
When I felt that when I was reading Hannah Arendt's Origins of Totalitarianism. For me, that cosmic horror is the stringent nihilism of Nazi fascism.
Right, right.
I maybe that's just an effect of living when we live, but I don't need to imagine scaly monsters in order to get there. I just have to look at history.
That was the future for Lovecraft, of course.
But it's, you know, I think, I don't know, I guess living where we live now, for me, it's not can't be fun, it's the reality.
It's less of a mental exercise.
And to be honest, that's why I suggested this episode.
Oh wow.
You know, that, you know, I'm sitting here, you know, thinking, you know, I love Lovecraft, but then I'm watching TV and there's actually people with tiki torches on the streets stuff, and it's like,
yeah,
this isn't it's anymore.
And to some degree, I feel like this is dark, but I think we are at a cultural moment that is very cognizant with Lovecraft's own. Very cognate with Lovecraft's own.
Yeah.
And that's what makes this not something that I would revisit for affective purposes.
Yeah.
It's interesting from a kind of cultural studies perspective. Because one of the things that you know, I didn't get a chance to talk about, and I'm not going to belabor the point, but so much of his writing about, you know, Ben, I think you aptly point to the way his misogyny finds outlet in these kinds of creatures that he creates. And they're also extraordinarily excremental. And the kinds of people who worship them are also broached in excremental terms. And that gets at this kind of psychology of disgust, which is connected to racism, to othering. We find the other disgusting and displace all of our own, you know, disgusting tendencies onto that other. That's kind of the route back there. There's something fascinating about this from a sort of cultural study standpoint, but I don't know, it's just not fun for me. But I'm not trying to say it can't be fun for anybody.
Well, I think you hit it.
It's
I think you hit upon it there, Claude, by saying, like, it's not something that you would go to for affective purposes. And I think that ties into sort of the broader, you know, that's what we talk about on the Cannonball all the time, is that you know, we're sort of you know, what Bloom was attempting to do, and what I think we were doing a lot better than Bloom, honestly. I'm going to toot our own horn and say we have a much better understanding of everything than that guy, that desiccated old husk of a man. But that is to say that the kind of reading for the affective purpose, if you're going to read something for the purpose of getting a thrill or an enjoyment, or if there's some compelling reason, you know, then that's why you're going to read it. If it doesn't work for you that way, it doesn't work for you that way. And that's, you know, and that's all there is to it. You know, it's the kind of thing, like, I kind of feel similarly about the fact that I do enjoy the stories of Robert E. Howard, right? The Conan the Barbarian stories. I think they're absolutely terrific as stories. I think I enjoy the affect I experience as I read them. He didn't go as out of his way to be as racist as H.P. Lovecraft, but it's still really damn racist a lot of the time because he always relies on Orientalist depictions of non-Western peoples. He always leans on racist stereotypes of physiognomy for his descriptions of characters. It's just there.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I just want to say that this is something that all of the pulp writers that I've read, they were drawing on the trash science of the time to write the trash literature.
Right, and that includes the trash race science. You're absolutely right.
I absolutely adore Princess of Mars, the Barsoom series, John Carter and the Savage Apes of Mars.
Yeah.
And it's all, I mean, it's based on a piece of science that was provably wrong 100 years before it was written.
right.
But, you know, the canals of Mars and all that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was complete trash.
But you're right, but it's a transporting affect, though. I mean, I'm with you. Yeah. But I think this was, fellas, this was a wonderful conversation. I really think, Claude, thank you so much for, I guess, staking out the anti-Lovecraft poll here. And
well, I feel like if any episode gets me death threats, it's probably going to be this one.
Well, I will happily lay down my life to protect you, Claude. You are a national treasure, and I will hear nothing, no ill words about you. And the same goes for you, Ben. Totally. This has been marvelous. I want to tell you, the audience, I don't know how much Agora is built around personalities, but I've been a correspondent via social media and email with Ben for years now, and this was the first time we actually had a live conversation. And
yes,
Ben,
yes,
you're a tremendous conversationalist and a just a stupendous interlocutor, and I appreciate
you
helping us cover this this contentious and weird territory of Lovecraft and his legacy, man. This has been tremendous. Well,
thank you so much for having me on. I'm a great admirer of the Cannonball and other shows, and you know, so this is great for me too. And I'm Claude. I'm really glad you were willing to serve your role for this one, because it contributed obviously to making this a great show.
I loved it. No, because I really was curious. You had this. You know, we've kind of been, I guess, before we went on air, you were playing with this idea of kitsch and camp, and I think you articulated that, you know, extraordinarily well. And I understand your position, and I guess that's what it comes down to. I guess this is what Daniel was trying to say, is that sometimes the aesthetic is personal, and I'm not trying to blast yours. I'm just saying it's not mine. But
totally fair.
I have enjoyed, one of my favorite books is Molloy by Samuel Beckett, the first 100 pages of which are an unindented paragraph. That's one of the best things I've ever read in my entire life. I don't expect anyone to get behind that one.
Yeah.
So, anyway. But yeah, thank you guys both so much. This was a whole lot of fun. And if anyone's still listening at this point, go read Lovecraft or don't.
Yeah. But what you do have to do is listen to Wittenberg to Westphalia by our good friend Ben Jacobs here, our Agora sister show. It's absolutely tremendous. Anyone who is at all interested in history, you'll absolutely love it. Because Ben's passion for the topic of history in general and his commitment to doing it right is just truly phenomenal, and honestly a lot rarer than you might think in the podcast world. So please check out Wittenberg to Westphalia.
Thank you very much. And just a quick note, if you're interested in what my favorite kitschy movie is, it is Bruce Lee Strikes Back from the Grave. Check it out.
It's fantastic. I absolutely will.
All right,
well, I guess I'll sign us off here, and thank you everybody for listening. This has been the Cannonball special agoraphobia episode, and we'll see y'all next time. Good night, everybody.
A warm welcome back to those of you who made it back, and a little bit of advice to take with you before you go. Not all knowledge is safe, and some things you can't unhear. The smartest of you will count your blessings and stay clear of dark corners and dangerous downloads. But those of you more daring who laugh in the face of fear, will undoubtedly be back, like a moth drawn to the flame, for the next installment of Agoraphobia.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.